upbeat tone on Wall Street thanks to a rise in commodity prices.
In terms of the recovery from the Great Recession, the U.S. economy is really doing quite well. You know, unemployment rate 4.4%. Stock market is up, as you mentioned. Job creation, confidence, all those things are very positive.
Well, I think the equity market is clearly looking at this global synchronized earnings recovery and the fact that you've got economies like Europe and emerging markets growing now.
The market's strong. We're just finishing a good earnings season. It's very strong. Jobless numbers are the lowest in years. The market's doing well. The VIX back up in double digits. We were single digits there for a while. So overall, the technicals are very strong for the market, and it's a good sign.
And it'll be, I think, the end of a pretty successful episode where the Fed used its balance sheet to help get us back to full employment. And now that we're there, they're going to gradually, cautiously allow it to unwind. So it'll be, I think, not a big deal for markets or for the economy.
We're going to be swinging around for 4 years, I think, with this White House and Congress and Senate. I mean, it's just a constant volatility.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's been a negative week for stocks this week. A lot of political drama coming out of Washington and some earnings disappointment on some key companies sent stocks south. We had a big drop during the middle of the week. About the only thing looking good this week has been the utility average. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Up in hour one, Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray will be joining me. Craig is very, very bullish. And he said all this sideways action that we've seen in the market is nothing but a correction in time. He wants to emphasize that we are in a structural bull market, two factors that are driving stocks. You want to hear what he has to say about that and his favorite sectors. Also joining me later on in the program will be Gene Epstein from Barron's, and he's talking about what's going on in the economy. He thinks the best that we can do this year is a little over 2%. Forget those 3% and 4% numbers, even if we get tax cuts and infrastructure spending. He'll tell you why he thinks the economy is on a slow growth path. He'll be joining me in hour one, along with Ryan Poplava, as we look at what moved the market this week. All of that coming up in the first hour.
And I'm John Loeffler, and for the big picture today, Jim will go on the record. This is a compilation of all of the emails we have received from you people in recent times, answering your questions and concerns. So that's our big picture today on the Financial Sense News Hour. And then welcome back, Ryan Poplava. It's time for taking a look at the markets this week. This week has proven to be an interesting one as the market finally took the political curveballs being thrown a tad more seriously. It's a lot more noise and fury. That's what it was this week. I'm not sure how much substance was in there. But it seems U.S. stocks began to bounce back to lessen the blow towards the end of the week. So aside from the political controversy surrounding former FBI Director Comey, what else was going on Wall Street?
Well, John, I think the remarks from the New York Times article Tuesday night that Trump told Comey, "I hope you can let this go," did get a little too much credit, I think, for the correction. It was definitely the match that lit that 1.8% drop in the S&P, which was the worst day correction actually since September last year. The key areas affected Wednesday were reflationary or Trump trades. That also kind of alludes to what was driving that correction. But I think the divergences I talked about last week, the drop in breadth, or what we call, you know, just the participation of how many stocks are involved in rallies since March, simply basically how narrow that rally has been over the past few weeks, coupled with, you know, looking at the volatility index, how much volatility people tend to expect based on investments and options, right down towards 9, all of that combined, to me, was communicating the market was vulnerable. And the fact that the Nasdaq had hit fresh highs, the Russell did briefly, the other indices couldn't and didn't. So the S&P, you know, very slightly by a few points, the Dow Industrials, transport still nowhere near the highs from March or February. You know, that kind of showed us that the market was vulnerable. And very much we saw that this week with one headline. and the market took a bit of a correction. So, you know, I mentioned last week how important the technical picture would be this week until we get to some more macro news next week. Actually, I looked at the correction this week and I looked at the areas that were weak. And the main thing that I took away from it, the most important communication I got from the market this week, you got to look at the treasury yields. And if you look at the curve, which has flattened between short-term treasuries and long-term treasuries, and then we also look at technically what's going on in the drop in yield from March, that to me has been the single most communicative indicator in the market, which basically is communicating that, okay, investors are worried about the economy. Things have slowed down a little bit from the first quarter. Expectations for monetary policy have come down. You know, there was the expectation heading into the March meeting that we would see 4 rate hikes this year, possibly, from the original estimation back in December towards 3. It ended up just being 3. And who knows what we'll see here in June. And then finally, the fiscal policy possibilities out of Washington. You know, there's a lot of fervor coming out of November and December, January, a lot of discussion of what Trump wanted to achieve. And then we got some problems trying to get that healthcare bill. And currently right now, when I last looked at what the White House was proposing on the tax reform, we talked about that, I think, 3 weeks ago. You know, it was pretty, I would say, way out in left field. You know, a corporate tax rate of 15%. I think from what I'm hearing from trading desk, they'd be happy if we saw something below 28%. So anyways, you know, things have changed since March. And if you look at the treasury yields, that's been communicating that change. Despite the rise up we've seen in the NASDAQ, despite the rise up we've seen in the S&P, right back up towards fresh highs, you got to look at the treasury yields, because if we're going to head up higher based on, you know, strong economic results, based on expectations that maybe monetary policy is going to continue to be gradual and not really be too aggressive, you know, we're going to see those yields climb up gradually. And that's what you really want to start to see if we're going to head up back towards those all-time highs recently. So definitely keep your eye on the treasuries.
Will do. And that's a good backup to the current conditions, which I think paints a fairly good picture as to why U.S. stocks have been consolidating here. So what's going to help break stocks free from the running correction or sideways trading market?
Well, for starters, we need to see economic conditions improve. Like I mentioned, there was those three areas that I talked about that those treasuries are communicating, which they have actually. We've looked at last week, I talked about the retail sales had improved. The issue with the retail sales and retail just in general, look at the carnage in the earnings results from some of those mall stocks that we talked about last week. And there were some today, this week, and I think Target did okay, but quite a few areas just, you know, very weak on those mall stocks. And then this week, the Empire Manufacturing Index did come in a little light. In fact, I think it was like -1. But the Philadelphia Fed, that was announced on Thursday, kind of helped reverse some of the Trump Comey weakness. It came in very strong at 38.8 versus 22 in April. And that's one of those soft data figures. And then we're just getting that. Industrial production was up in April by 1%. That's actually the strongest advance since February 2014. So another positive indication that things might be turning around here for the second quarter. Overall, some decent economic news this week. The other small help we saw was in energy. Obviously, it's not a fundamental indicator. It's not an economic indicator. But a lot of technicians, a lot of fundamental analysts, a strategist look at energy, what's going on there, what's going on in the price of energy, and what's going on in the price of copper, what's going on in the price of iron. You know, things have been weak over there in China on demand. I think things improved a little bit this week. But looking at energy, I talked about it last week where there were some rumors that OPEC and Russia would consider extending their cuts by 9 months. You know, they're going to be meeting here, I think, next week. The other rumor that came out this week that helped strengthen oil more was that they might be possibly increasing those cuts. So looking at the economy, we want to see energy doing fairly well. That kind of communicates, like I said, with Dr. Copper, what's going on in the economy. The West Texas crude hit $44 2 weeks ago when we last spoke, John. And on that day, there was a reversal in the market and we headed down and then came right back up midday to close pretty strongly. And that was the short-term bottom recently. And currently, you know, with all that's been going on, all the rumors, crude now is at 50 spot 81, right above its 50-day moving average. So definitely some improvement there on energy, some improvement in the economy. And next week, I think we'll get the Fed minutes from the May meeting. So that'll be another little catalyst here that'll communicate what's going on with those three main areas I talked about.
Sounds like despite all the talks about impeachment and what that could do to the pro-growth strategy from Republicans. By the way, impeachment is a long way off if that happens. We've been comparing that here to Watergate and looking at what happened there and what it would take to bring that around. But, you know, I think at some point this is going to lower down. Cooler heads prevailed later in the week in the markets, especially with a rebound, by the way. And that was coupled with stronger fundamentals. That's good. You know, it's quite strange that Brazil was going through somewhat of a similar controversy regarding President Temer silencing the former speaking using money. Their market was clobbered like, what, 8% down, but that didn't seem to affect the U.S. So anyway, what's on the list for next week, Ryan? You've alluded to a heavier catalyst week ahead the last time we spoke.
So yeah, back to what you were mentioning, John, impeachment is very much, like you said, it's a long process. It's a very political process, despite a lot of the communication about obstruction of justice, this being maybe a legal issue. And the Republicans have the House and the Senate. So it'd be very difficult unless, you know, politically the whole entire public really just got behind that this being a major issue. And you know, on this item, Comey will be talking next week. He'll be testifying. So we could get some more information on that. That could swing things from where they were on Wednesday and then the rebound on Thursday and Friday. And I think the rebound on Thursday, there was some mention that Comey had said that he didn't feel pressured by the administration. That obviously that was a while ago compared to comments we've heard recently. So, you know, 2019 might be a different matter. You know, if the Republicans can't show a cohesive strategy here to move forward on deregulation, infrastructure, and tax reform, you know, the voters might change their opinion. And that could easily happen. And that means both houses will have to work together over the next course of this year and next year. But moving on, John, next week, Trump will propose the U.S. can balance its budget over the next 10 years through very deep cuts in social programs and additional economic growth. So we're going to hear from him on his long-term plan. And then we'll get the May flash purchasing managers index data on Wednesday. So that's a fresh flow of data, getting an idea of what's going on with the economy here in May. And then the May 3rd Federal Open Market Committee meeting notes will be released also as well on Wednesday. So sometimes they change the language and sometimes the market reacts to that. But anyways, John, things could definitely pick up next week in headlines, even though we got quite a few zingers this week. It should be interesting.
Yeah, and the most important part will be testimony, but there are a lot of complicating factors to that. And so that remains to be seen. So we'll see where it goes. It's nowhere yet, all right? It's a lot of noise at this stage, although it was enough noise to make everybody nervous. Okay, Ryan Poplava, appreciate it. I guess these are interesting times, right, one way or the other. So we'll look forward to talking about this next week and see how far we have crawled in this whole process. Thanks, Ryan.
Sure thing, John. Talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Bitcoin is increasingly accepted by merchants of all different types. It's got more network effects that are taking root. We're now to the point where it takes more than an ounce of gold to buy a Bitcoin. And that was a big landmark to pass. There's actually a major Japanese Forex company that is now letting people trade Bitcoin. So you borrow yen at 0% interest rate and buy Bitcoin, and yens are not limited in amount and Bitcoins are. And the Bank of Japan actively wants to devalue the yen to make their exports competitive. So I think this could get really crazy.
Well, for the markets this week, it's been a bit of a setback. Stocks have been going sort of sideways over the last couple months outside the NASDAQ. What does that mean? Is this just a pause that refreshes, or is there something more ominous ahead of us? Joining us on the program is Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray. Craig, let's begin with the NASDAQ. We hit 2,400. I know one of your targets for the year was 2,424, but we've been sort of in this sideways pattern. I don't care if you're looking at the Dow, you're looking at the S&P 500, if you're looking at the Russell, it's been sort of sideways back and forth, not really doing much of anything over the last 2 months. What is that telling you?
Well, Jim, as I look at all these popular averages, and you and I have talked about on this show before that you can have two types of corrections in the market. You can have corrections in time, and you can have corrections in price. And so far, what we have been seeing, largely post the kind of Trump election, has been these corrections in time. Breadth of the market narrows quite a bit, and then you start to see it expand again, and you start to see the next leg up start to unfold in the market. And as I look, Jim, through all the popular averages, whether it's the Dow, whether it's the S&P, whether it's the NASDAQ composite, it feels like we're in some sort of time correction. And when you think back to what happened earlier this week with a 300 and change point sell-off, is people thought that was starting to unfold into a price correction. I'm not so sure that's going to be the case, Jim. I think you're just going to get more of a continuation of a time correction than price.
And Craig, do you see that reflected? For example, we take a look at the major sectors within the S&P. There's only two sectors that really stand out, which have been consumer discretionary and then once again, technology.
Yeah, I think from a sector level perspective, I mean, it's one of the lifelines of any sort of positive market or bullish advance in the market has been sector rotation. And we've seen some pretty good sector rotation. Again, if you think back to this year, we started out with kind of an inflationary trade that then got set back when the healthcare bill did not get done in a timely fashion. And that became a little bit of a resetting of expectations for investors. And then you saw a growth trade start to kind of morph out of that inflation trade. And you've seen the technology stocks continue to work their way higher. At this point in time, I think you're going to see some further rotation in this market. I think you're going to continue to see weakness in the staples. And from our sector level perspective, Jim, we are overweight energy, which up until now has been a little bit of a weak spot for us. We've also been overweight basic materials and overweight tech. We're recommending underweights on staples, utilities, and the consumer cyclical stocks, as that cyclical stocks continue to still be under a lot of pressure, as there is an entire transformation of the retail space underway at this point in time. And then, Jim, there's one other big kind of concept that I want to lay out to all the listeners today, which is this, that we need to think about this as a bull market, but also as a structural bull market. And what I mean by that, Jim, is that in the current market we're in, we have, about 20-25% fewer stocks today than we had in 2000. We're also seeing huge share buybacks in the marketplace. If we get a repatriation bill of any of these outside dollars, that's going to be going to dividends and also to further share buybacks. So if you think about what's happening, this entire market continues to shrink. And as we do see the market shrink and money starts to come in out of fixed income back into equities, this is going to be a structural move higher for equities. And again, I think this is not a one-year move. I think this is probably a 5 or 10 year advance that we'll see in the marketplace. And because of that, any of these little dips that we see in the market, like we saw earlier this week, I want to be buyers of these dips for the longer term.
I want to talk about two fundamental factors here that could really change the outcome of this market, maybe be a catalyst. If you take a look at the president's tax bill, one, depending on whether you're looking at the president's tax bill or Congress's tax bill, one would lower the tax rate to 20% on corporations from 35. The other one would be 15. So, Craig, if I have $100 of earnings as a company and I'm paying $35 in tax, Congress reduces that to $20 or 15% in tax. All of a sudden, instead of paying $35 in tax, I'm only paying 15 or 20. That bumps up my earnings. There's one catalyst that I could think of. The second one, that's a possibility, which you just referred to. If Congress passes a bill and says there's, $2.5 trillion of untaxed profits overseas, and they're saying, hey, if you bring it back here and invest it, you can pay a one-time tax of 10%. I mean, that's an awful lot of money.
Absolutely it is. And Jim, I would kind of boil this down for the listeners as this. If we're going to put up about $130 and change in earnings this year, the forecast is for about another 10% growth next year. Now, that doesn't even include any sort of benefit from tax cuts that you might see at the corporate or at the individual level. And what I've been seeing and reading, Jim, is for every 1% cut in the tax rate, you're probably going to see a 1% pickup in bottom line earnings growth. So if we walk through that, you could be talking about north of 10% earnings growth for stocks next year. And under that kind of scenario, maybe you're looking at $145 or $150 in earnings, Jim. So if the multiple of the market stays flat to where we are now, and again, historically, peak multiples at the end of bull markets have been north of 20 times. The average post-World War II has been about 16 and a half. You're not terribly expensive. A lot of people say that we're at nosebleed levels. And at this point in time, I don't believe that that is the case at all. But if you roll that simple multiple flat, you're looking at a market that's certainly a lot higher than where we are now, and certainly higher than my 24-24 target, Jim.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, because at the beginning of the year, Craig, you have been one of the more bullish analysts that we've had on the program, but this year, your forecast of 24-24 was a little bit lower than some of the top forecasts, calling for maybe 2,500. What would it take for you to move that forecast to 24-24 even higher?
Well, I always find that I make more friends on the street when my targets actually get hit. Okay? So I think we've laid out the scenario just moments ago of the potential upside for this market. For me to change my target, I just want to say, boom, it got hit, and we'll adjust it. And I do think there's upside with these numbers from here.
I want to move to another market that has also been in a sideways pattern, and that's the 10-year Treasury note. We've seen it move from 2.25% to 2.6%. What's your view on interest rates here?
Well, as I look at 10-year bond yields and where we're trading at, you know, right this second, my viewpoint is this, that 10-year bond yields are the absolute kind of thing that we need to understand the most for this market. The spread between the 2 and 10 years has certainly come in quite a bit lately. We've also seen 10-year bond yields now trading at, you know, 245. We were 240 late last week. We've been as high as 260 over the last couple of months, and we've been as low as about 210, 215. From my vantage point, Jim, we need to see some inflation expectations come into the market. And one of the misperceptions that I see happening with a lot of investors around the world is simply this. Everybody believes that the Fed is on a one-track path of just purely raising rates. Now, think about the entire yield curve, right? At the very short end of the yield curve, the Fed is like a floor jack. When they raise rates, lower rates, it happens instantaneously. But at the long end, they have less control. So the inflation expectations have to get set by the bond market. And right now, bond investors don't believe that there's going to be a lot of inflation. And they're also worried that with the flattening of the yield curve, that is suggesting that there's going to be some sort of weak economic environment ahead. I will tell you right now, right today on the show, that the Fed is not going to be aggressively raising rates. You got more people at the White House that are savvy to the market than you've had at any other point in time, or probably over the last 8 years. And they are not going to raise rates if they're going to continue to see the 2 to 10 spread continue to narrow. They're going to stay on the sidelines. And that's what I think will ultimately be the shift in psychology that investors are going to have to face, certainly in June and definitely July, when I think that you're going to see the Fed stay on the sidelines, probably through both of those meetings. And if that is indeed the case, look for 10-year bond yields to move up. And then we're going to go challenge a 31-year downtrend on 10-year bond yields. And that downtrend line is sitting at about 275.3. I know Bill Gross has talked about 266, but Jim, I'm not that good. I'm not going to call a 31-year trend reversal on 10-year bonds to two decimal places. I'm going to give it a little bit of wiggle room. And as we move above that 275 level, you're going to start to get the asset allocation shift that we've talked about. And I'm not changing my forecast of 3 to 3.25 on the 10-year bond yield by year end.
I want to come back to one of the sectors that you're very big on, which is energy. Craig, why do you think, if you take a look at the Spider XLE, why it hasn't performed or energy hasn't performed at this point yet?
Well, Jim, I think it all comes down to the crude oil price. There's been a bit of a, on the fundamental side, a bit of a supply glut that has come into the market. You've now got OPEC talking about cutting production and pushing out those production cuts even further. You've also saw a technical breakdown happen on crude oil prices, you know, in the early part of May when you broke below the lower end of a price channel that had been forming since basically back in August of last year. That led to a big sell-off in crude oil prices. And I know a lot of investors basically stepped aside at that point in time and gave up on energy. People want to see oil prices move higher, and that is why you've seen a lot of these ETFs and a lot of the energy stocks just not perform well. It's been the weak crude oil price and the belief that there's a huge amount of oversupply. Now, Jim, I'd also come back and just say that one of the biggest IPOs in the world is going to be happening in the next 12 months or so. And from a very simplistic standpoint, is that IPO going to be better being priced at $70 for crude oil, or does it go off better at $30 for crude oil prices? I think we know the answer for that.
So as the market comes into balance, and the reports that I read, Craig, that the inventories are continuing to drop even here, and that perhaps we do run into balance by the end of the year, which some are saying that that could lead to maybe $60 oil prices or better, that would be good for the energy sector. Let's talk about another commodity. If you take a look at last year in December, and that's gold, we've seen higher lows and higher highs. Right now, gold has been trying to trend upward again. What's your take on gold here?
If you look at gold starting in December, yes, you've made some higher highs and higher lows. But this is where, Jim, I like to come back and look at the very long-term chart of gold. And when you go back and you think about history, and again, it may not repeat, but it probably will rhyme. And you think about what happened in the early 1980s, 81 to be exact. You saw interest rates peak. You started the big secular bull market that lasted until 1999. And gold peaked at the same point. Now, I look at this cycle and how it's unfolding. Gold has peaked in the September timeframe of 2012. And when you draw your downtrend resistance line into this, you're going to be touching at the highs in June of 2016. And you had recently failed again at that downtrend resistance line back in the end of April. So, Jim, my viewpoint on gold is pretty simple. I'd be selling the relief rallies. I still believe that gold is on its way to at least 1050, if not lower. And I think other asset classes make a lot more sense, equities primarily being one of them.
So given this sort of sideways action and then the pullback that we've seen this week, if you were putting money to work, would you stick with the three sectors you talked about, technology, energy, and materials?
I would be buying those sectors. I think you got to be very selective when you're buying in the energy sector at this point in time. We recently made some changes to the model portfolio that we've got, Jim, and we added some more refinery exposure and kind of emphasized that over the E&P companies. In terms of basic materials, the chemical stocks look great, and I'd be over-indexing in those inside of the basic space. Along with inside of technology, semiconductors, I want to selectively add there also, as I continue to think that that's a very good spot inside the technology sector. I'm also starting to see some of the 3D printing names, Jim, that have been, you know, very popular among investors starting to show some signs of life too. But again, selectively adding to those kind of names.
So if we were to summarize, Craig, the key point you would like to get across to investors is rather than cyclical, you see this as a structural bull market. And for our listeners, what that means, that is longer lasting. Cyclical bull markets tend to be shorter in duration. In two factors that you cite here that are strengthening this is one, there are fewer shares outstanding. And number two, corporations have been big buyers of stock. So in many ways, they're shrinking the stock base.
That is correct. You can look at Home Depot as an example for that. IBM has done that for years, continuing to buy back stock. You look at Apple having issued debt, but then turn around and buy back their own stock with some of those dollars. And Jim, the other part that I would add into that too is that there is just a fewer number of stocks. I look at our proprietary war plan application, Jim, and in 2000, we had over 6,000 stocks inside of that market tool. Today, we have about 4,700 and change. So again, this whole market has shrunk, and it looks like it's continuing to shrink. That, to me, is going to be the old adage of too many dollars chasing too few stocks, and I think we ultimately know what direction the market goes when that occurs. And then, Jim, I'd also just add a little anecdotal thing. I had a good conversation with one of our guests that we all know, Mr. Ralph Acampora, and he has, you know, said at some recent conferences and things that when he looks back at history, what was the most difficult period of time for investors? And it was actually in the 1960s. And the reason it was difficult is not because the market was going up. It's just that very few people believed that it would continue to go higher. And because of that, they could not re-engage in equities and really start to buy things or hang on to them. And it wasn't the big crashes you saw in the 30s that was the most difficult. They saw some of those coming, but it was nobody believed in the bull market that was unfolding in the 60s. Feels very similar to what we have today, because as I've marketed around Europe over the last couple months, pretty much people are lugging around excess cash at this point in time, and they're hoping for some sort of dip and pullback to put money to work in this market. That was a good thing this week that happened when we got that little minor pullback in the market, because people could step up and buy stocks.
Well, certainly, if you take a look at fund flows, which we follow, Craig, it's been surprising since this bull market began in 2009. The bulk of investor money, and I'm talking about individual investor money, has flowed into the bond market. It hasn't flowed into stock markets.
And that's interesting because people are fearful. They still have the very painful memories of 2000, painful memories of 2007, 8, and 9, stuck firmly in their minds at this point in time, which creates a big anchoring point for them and their feelings toward the markets. Now, Jim, I'll tell you, though, when we start seeing rates move north of 2.75-3, these wonderful listeners are going to open up their statements and they're going to say, wow, I'm losing money in fixed income. I wasn't sure that that could really happen. And then they're going to call their advisor and the advisor is going to say, maybe we should rotate a little bit, put some more money into some of these dividend-paying blue-chip stocks that are buying back their shares. And I think you'll start to see some of that rotation take place at that point in time, Jim.
Well, listen, Craig, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
So, Jim, they can find our work. They can go out to the Piper Jaffray website. If they would like to reach out to me, I can be found at craig.w.johnson@pjc.com, Jim.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Kathy Ruby from College Coach. And Kathy, let's begin and talk in terms of financing a college education. There's work programs, there's grants, there's various government loan programs. What does a parent do? Let's say you have an Einstein in the family, and Einstein is graduating in May. Now you have to decide, okay, he's been accepted to several schools. What's the first thing a parent should consider?
Well, certainly you're going to want to look at what the bottom line is at each of those schools. So hopefully, if it's before May and the student Einstein has been accepted at a variety of places, hopefully the family has gone through the financial aid process where they've filled out the federal financial aid form and maybe an institutional financial aid form. They've had the student considered for scholarships at the institution. And so now what they need to really do is compare the bottom line at each of the different institutions. Look at what the college says it will cost, do some research on the website to make sure that the estimate they're giving is accurate for the program your student is in and for the kind of dorm they're going to live in and the kind of board plan they might buy, and try to figure out what the true bottom line is at each institution.
Well, economic growth in the first quarter of this year has been somewhat weak, but everybody's hopeful that economic growth will pick up, and along with it, the stock market. Joining us on the program from Barron's is Gene Epstein. Gene, I want to talk about an article you wrote in the weekend edition of Barron's, Hopes for a Trump Jump Look Overblown. Let's talk about why you think that the economy accelerating to 3-4% may be somewhat hard, but let's begin with the thought that in this economic recovery, economic growth has been tepid, 2.1%, probably the slowest since World War II. What accounts for that, given the amount of stimulus that has come from government and deficits?
Well, the simple overarching answer to that question is the Economic Freedom Index, which I've tried to promote, Economic Freedom Index as sponsored by the Fraser and Cato Institutes, which are a very free market, has been declining under Obama, and indeed, it started declining under George W. Bush. And It's a multi-part index that tracks the degree to which the markets and individuals are permitted economic freedom. It tracks the heavy hand of government, of regulation. It tracks the degree to which government allows free trade. And all of the parts of the economic freedom index declined again under George W. Bush and continued to decline under Barack Obama. And that's the broad answer. But then, because if you then parse it out and you look at the degree to which regulation continued to strangle the market, you look at the degree to which regulatory reforms were actually strengthening the large companies and weakening the small companies, then you begin to understand why the economy grew as slowly as it did. I should hasten to say that I wouldn't necessarily have expected 4% growth, which is the real gold standard, even though I personally believe that a free market, a truly free market, can achieve 6 and 7% growth on a pretty steady basis. I wouldn't have expected 4% within the normal course of events, mainly because the baby boomers have been retiring and the growth in the labor force, therefore, has slowed. But there would have been every reason to expect an extra percentage point per year under Obama. And as you know, of course, with the power of compounding, that extra percentage point would have made a huge difference year after year after year.
Let's talk about something else that, in addition to tepid economic growth, something that we've seen a phenomenon in this economic recovery that we haven't seen too much in the past, and that is a very strong growth rate that occurs in the second and third quarter, and then it weakens in the first quarter of the year. Is this seasonal adjustments that is doing this? I mean, what accounts for that weakness half of the year and then strength in the other half?
You said it. And I hope those two words didn't already put your listeners to sleep, seasonal adjustment. And it's specifically the following, that that it is indeed necessary to do what is called seasonally adjusting quarterly data. I mean, the most extreme case of the need for seasonal adjustment is actually in the employment data. In the month of January, the payroll employment in the U.S. falls by 2 to 3 million every January. But of course, if we reported that and if we responded to it, we would be reacting foolishly, because that January decline, which is again in the millions, is just the reaction after the buildup in December. And so that month is reported in the employment data as possibly an up month. If the decline is less than usual, that means that something underlying is happening, and so it gets reported as a positive. That's part of the game. Now, seasonal adjustment happens in the GDP numbers, but oddly, what also is going on is that the Bureau of Economic Analysis that does the seasonal adjustment only seasonal adjusts the specific components of GDP, which are many. You know, there are hundreds of components of GDP. Those components are seasonally adjusted, but because the process, the method is inexact, there is a residual that is a bit distortive. They don't adequately seasonally adjust up the decline in the first quarter. Again, the first quarter, as you might imagine, tends to decline because it's the winter months, and it's a slowdown from the spurt in the holiday spurt in October and November and December. But oddly, now get to this point. So therefore, what happens is that there's an aggregate, if I may use that word with your readers, an aggregate sort of residual error. Now, it's easy enough to spot if you actually look at the data and sort of seasonally adjust the aggregate number. And you might ask, why doesn't the Bureau of Economic Analysis do a second round and seasonally adjust a second time once it sees that aggregate error? I actually believe it should do so. I don't see any particular reason why it shouldn't, but because they're a bunch of sort of statistical wonks, they do not do so. And then oddly, a bit of an error creeps into the fourth quarter as well, for somewhat different reasons, which I won't go into. But of course, over the course of a year, the only punchline to understand is that if there's an error in seasonal adjustment in one quarter, then it's going to be compensated for in the following quarters. And so that's the reason why the second and third quarter tend to look strong because there's a reaction, and because the math dictates that the seasonal adjustment is going to be such that the second and third quarter are going to look strong. So perhaps I needn't belabor the point anymore. It's all technical. By the way, you know, because as you know, seasonal adjustment is done rather crudely in the stock market. When earnings are reported, they're always reported that, you know, for this quarter, earnings were up a certain percentage from the same quarter a year ago. The same quarter a year ago, of course, is the same season, and so they compare it with a year ago. And sometimes I think that that's the way the BEA ought to report their numbers as well, that cruder version, which in a way keeps you to reality. But maybe we needn't belabor it any further and simply say that it's a somewhat a statistical illusion, and there's always an expectation then that the first quarter is going to look unusually weak, and then we know, and of course there's going to be other aspects that will rebound in the second quarter. The second quarter is probably going to be north of 3% when it comes in. It's going to look like a Trump jump or a Trump bump. There will be a victory lap, but it's going to be short-lived because it probably won't last through the third and fourth quarters. And for the year, we probably won't do much better than about 2%.
I wonder if you might explain to our listeners some of the obstacles that the Trump administration faces, which is the workforce growing and also productivity. If you could explain the relationship, because if you add more workers and those workers are more productive, you're actually producing more stuff in the economy.
Well, you're actually asking two questions at the same time, because the first question is, why is the workforce growing so slowly? I mentioned that we can, those of us who complain about the workforce growing so slowly, at first have to acknowledge that you'd expect it to happen because the baby boomers, who were, of course, in the workforce in the 90s, and in, even in the early 90s, they were entering the workforce, the younger baby boomers were. So you had a workforce growth, natural demographics that were contributing to that growth. And so now the workforce growth is slowing because the baby boomers are retiring. So you might say that's normal demographics, even though, of course, you would say that there might be a radical reform might have been put in place to raise the Social Security retirement age a bit more rapidly than it has been raised. When Social Security was originally put in place, life expectancy was 65, and Social Security began at the age 65. Now people are far healthier, they're living longer. I myself, by the way, am 72 years old, and I expect to work another 10 years. I enjoy my work. To that extent, I'm a very privileged person for enjoying my work. But the idea that people should be supported on Social Security by younger workers when they're at the age of 70, 71, they're quite fit to continue working, I think is a bit unjust. So there should be a reform put in place to accelerate the age of full benefits for Social Security. But that's something we live on the baby boomer side. But now look on the side of the younger people. The labor force participation rate of prime age men and women has declined. They're not in the workforce. Now what the numbers are that one out of every eight prime age male is not working. That's at a record high. It makes no sense at all, especially makes no sense that so many of them are on a federal disability. And if you anybody who just examines the disability program would recognize it for its abuses, that a lot of people are taking disability who actually are quite fit to work. And so that's the other reason why we have a slowdown, because fewer able-bodied workers, working age people from 25 to 54, I would even say, of course, able-bodied and working age is like 25 easily to 64, both men and women are not entering the workforce as they might normally do so. And so that's a problem on that end. We have fewer workers available, and that's, of course, the reason why we have such a low unemployment rate of 4.4%, because not a whole lot of it. So few of these people, relative to the past, want to enter the workforce. So we do have a tight labor market, but only partly because so many people are staying on the sidelines. And surely the excuse cannot be that no work is available. In fact, all the indicators are that so many jobs are actually going begging. Plenty of work is available. So that's a problem. But then when you ask about productivity, productivity is, of course, the output side. And in a way, it's asking the same question you asked earlier, which is, why is that output output not increasing? Why is innovation and entrepreneurship operating at a much slower rate? And I believe, again, that's because of the heavy hand of regulation, of other ways in which the game is being rigged to make it more difficult for innovation and other parts of productivity growth, make it more difficult for them to flourish.
Gene, and there's a number of proposals that the administration has on its agenda to stimulate the economy. They want to talk about deregulation, which may get to your economic freedom index. They want to talk about infrastructure spending, and then they also want to talk about tax cuts. If there was one thing the administration could do to really get economic growth beyond this 2% tepid growth that we've seen over the last 8 years, in your opinion, what would that be?
Yes. Well, I like the way you've laid out that menu of options, because I do want to speak to the two I would reject. With respect to infrastructure spending, you would think that when you have a situation in which federal, state, and local governments spend every year more than $450 billion on infrastructure, you'd think that the first question you'd ask is, where does all that money go? Where is it being spent? And then when you ask a few more questions, you find that that $450 billion of infrastructure spending is an absolute jungle of corruption and waste, and even situations in which roads and infrastructure get destroyed because of the way trucks pay for their pricing on the roads. And then you find, if you take the next step and actually read up on what some of the think tank scholars have devised about infrastructure spending, you find that easily $100 billion of that money is being wasted or is absolutely harmful. So then you find that maybe if we do need pressing infrastructure projects, Hillary Clinton, by the way, wanted to spend an extra $50 billion a year on infrastructure. And I've just said that probably $100 billion is being wasted. Then you find that maybe we can actually reduce that $450 billion and pay for the infrastructure projects that actually have to be tended to once we try to reform all the corruption in infrastructure. So that's what I would propose in that regard. And I will, of course, also point out, if the Trump administration wants to boost infrastructure spending, they ought to realize that the market for construction workers is very tight. And when they move into this and they start creating jobs in this field, all they're really going to do for the economy in terms of growth is actually just choke out and crowd out marginal projects in the private sector. They're just going to lose their workforce to the infrastructure projects that government is going to install, because if government ramps up spending, that's what's going to happen, versus what I propose, which is examine where the waste occurs and reallocate in such a way with the resources that you do have to spend the money more prudently to address the infrastructure projects that really do have to be addressed. With respect to the tax cuts, I do think that a cut in the corporate income tax is a good idea, because the U.S. has close to the highest rate in the world and is therefore non-competitive. It will probably be a revenue gainer for the government, ironically, if they cut taxes. I could explain that, but it's a little detailed. Probably be a revenue gainer, and it would probably boost, to some degree, boost economic growth. So that's good. But while Milton Friedman, I never met a tax cut I didn't like. I have to say, beyond that, that what the government spends is really, in a way, what it taxes us by. The government is bleeding red ink, and the first thing it should do before it cuts the personal income tax is to cut spending. And I've written a cover story for Barron's in which I've outlined a way in which $8.6 trillion over 10 years could be cut if you just go for the low-hanging fruit, and the budget could be balanced in 8 years. And so I would go that route instead. But my form of tax cuts would take the form of spending cuts. Now, the third thing you've mentioned, deregulation, that I think is extremely promising. And I hate to sound as though I don't think business should ever be regulated, but there's no question that our regulatory structure is also corrupt. There's no question that the whole point about so much of our regulation, even from its inception, has been to protect and cartelize entrenched business against smaller business. And I think there's promising avenues, I'm told, indeed, that the deregulation of the financial markets could possibly get us to a situation in which the failure of Dodd-Frank regulation could be compensated for. Because all the Dodd-Frank regulation under Obama really did was make us potentially more vulnerable to another economic downturn, because it's really only strengthened the too big to fail banks against the smaller financial entities. So there I see potential. I also would advocate for the Trump administration that they try to persuade the states not to have so many restrictive licensure laws against the ability of people to move into different professions, not to have a situation in which masseurs have to pay such a fortune to get licenses to do that practice, or manicurists or other kinds of professions. When people get laid off, they should be able to go into those professions. So that would help as well. Well, I do think that while it's subtle, the effects of deregulation could be quite powerful.
So, Gene, given the likelihood of any of this happening, because there's difficulty even within the Republican Party on agreement for taxes and how taxes should be cut, there's disagreement in terms of how Obamacare should be reformed or repealed. So there's widespread disagreement within the president's party, and of course you have the opposition party. What is the likelihood that we end up the year and nothing really gets done?
Well, I think that, as I've argued in the article, it seems to be depressingly a wash. There are good things and bad things that will probably happen. Certainly, we haven't mentioned yet one of the bad things, which is Trump's initiatives against free trade, which I think which slows economic growth. But amazingly, a story that's not being adequately covered is that deregulation in different ways might well happen. Of course, perhaps the poster woman for deregulation is Betsy DeVos, who heads the Department of Education. It's not a department I particularly favor. I don't think the federal government should be in the education business. But Betsy DeVos favors charter schools, vouchers, private sector choices for poor people. That's a long-term solution, because I think their children could be better educated as a result. But I'm told that there is a fair amount happening in the financial deregulation part of the story. Mark Labria is a guy, an economist at the Cato Institute, who's actually written frequently for me at Barron's. He's written 6 book reviews for me at Barron's, and I was elated to learn that he'd been appointed Vice President Pence's chief economist, because Calabria is very, very sophisticated about financial regulation. So I think, actually, certain things are happening in those areas where the politicians often don't realize things are going on. So that's good. But as you indicate, other things are happening that may offset the effects, the good effects. And so the net, I believe, is the best guess is it's going to be a wash. The economy will continue to creep along at the Obama-like, snail-like pace of economic growth.
Gene, well, listen, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them about what you do at Barron's. You write a weekly column on Barron's for the weekend, but you also write other articles.
I write a weekly column called Economic Beat at Barron's Financial Weekly. Barron's, you know, goes to bed, as we journalists say, every Friday night. That's the weekly. And it's on doorsteps every Saturday morning, which, by the way, is the big reason why Barron's is still in its 96th year of publication, such a successful enterprise, while other publications like Business Week and Forbes are sort of on life support because they never had that publishing cycle. I also write features for Barron's, cover stories at Times. I mentioned my story on cutting the budget by $8.6 trillion over 10 years. And in addition to that, I'm the book review editor. Book reviews appear in Barron's once a month.
Coming up next on The Big Picture, Jim goes on the record, where we take a compilation of all of your emails that you've been sending in to us with questions and concerns and endeavor to answer them. As you well know, as a listener to the program, Jim does this periodically, and we will do it periodically. Coming up next as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at FinancialSense.com.